Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon with an open phone line so you can call in if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or the Christian life. I'd be glad to have you call in. We'll talk to you about it. If you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to talk about that, please call. We'll be glad to talk to you about that as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. All right. And I do have an announcement for those who live in Southern California. On Thursday mornings, and of course that's tomorrow morning, we have a weekly Bible study in the life of Christ. We're going through all four Gospels, harmonizing them. We've been taking our time, and we are currently still in the Sermon on the Mount, very near the end of the Sermon on the Mount, as a matter of fact, in Matthew 7. This is open to the public. We welcome you to join us. It's in the morning early on Thursdays at Panera Bread in Temecula. It's at 6:30 Thursday mornings in Temecula at Panera Bread. Now, that Panera Bread is located right across the street from Costco in Temecula. So we'd welcome you there if you happen to be an early riser and want to join us. Now, also in Temecula, on Friday night, we're having a Q&A meeting, and you're welcome to join us for that as well. If you're interested in those meetings, you can find the details that you'll need, the time and place, maps, instructions, things like that, at our website. You go to thenarrowpath.com, and you go to the tab that says Announcements, and scroll on down, and you'll find those meetings and the information about them. All right, let's talk to Jason from Auburn, California. Jason, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Steve, brother, it's good to hear your voice. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good. Hey, got to get you back here to Auburn very soon, so working on that. So.
Well, you know, I am coming up to Sacramento area. It's going to be an Easter weekend, which might make it not a very good weekend for a meeting on a Sunday at least, but there will be a Friday night in Rockland.
Okay. All right. I didn't see that on your announcements, but maybe.
It's not up there yet. That's at the end of March 30th. I'll be having a discussion with Doug Batchelor about the Sabbath.
Oh, gotcha. I will try to make that. So,
okay.
Well, I have a situation with a young man. I say young man. He's mid-30s. I'm early 50s. So his marriage is on the rocks, to say the least. I counseled with him yesterday. He's really brokenhearted. He's kind of been a one-foot-in, one-foot-out believer. I just really encouraged him to, you know, you gotta give it all to Christ and surrender, man. And he seems to really be receptive to that. His wife wants nothing to do with Christianity or anything, and they've been there's been some on his part since the last couple of years. It's been pretty rough. He's had some some text messaging, emotional affairs, nothing heavy on his part. She found out, went ballistic, rightfully so. But now it looks like, a very long story short, we talked for a couple hours, but it looks like she may be in a full-blown affair. He's not 100% sure, but from what I've seen, what he tells me, it was her boss. You know, they're out on a dinner date. I'm like, oh, man, this, you know, hand-palming my face.
So, yeah, this is very sad. What would your question to me be?
Well, my question would be, he asked me, so after all that, and I'm basically just telling him, you know what, you need to love your wife, even in the midst of this. And you do your part of keeping your vow, number one, and loving her. That's why I've said, whether she's expecting you or not. But my question would be, then he asked me, do I confront her at this point about the more than likely affair? And I kind of said, man, that's a tough one. But I'm going to have to say at this point, no, because she's would be very, I mean, the wall's probably already up. She wants him out of the house. And I just think it would drive her completely away. My question is was that good advice?
It could be. Of course, the dynamics in every marriage where people are alienated are not going to be exactly the same for any two couple, because of course everyone's an individual. It does sound like the situation is such that confronting her about it would not fix anything. And of course he's probably feeling a little bit of indignation about it, and also curiosity, and so he'd be tempted to ask or confront her about it, whether it's a wise thing to do or not. But I think it'd be good for him to not do so at this point until he finds out more. You know, does she profess to be a Christian?
Oh no, she's absolutely against.
Never was.
Christian,
so. Never was a Christian.
I believe she was raised in the church, kind of thing. But her parents were divorced when she was like 23. She's very hard heart. So she's very punitive towards him right now. Wants to punish him.
I've seen that myself at times.
Yes.
All I can say is, if you're asking whether your advice was good, I think I agree with your advice. I don't think that it'd be very wise for him to bring it up at this point in their relationship. I don't think the dynamics are such that it's going to make it helpful.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, it hurts. It hurts to hear the story.
Yeah, it does. It breaks my heart. He's heartbroken too. But all I could really say is, you know, you can't control her. You know, you made a vow, for better or for worse, and you're in the middle of the worst right now.
That's right.
Just, you know, love her anyway. and you may be surprised at how she softened toward them. So I guess I'll just have to see how things go. He's going to stay in touch with me to see at what point does he confront her or what that looks like. So,
well, that's an awful situation, and so many people are going through that kind of thing right now, and have been for in recent times. A lot of marriages are breaking up for no good reason, except that somebody's just angry. But on the other hand, if he was having emotional affairs texting, that's not nothing. I don't know that. I don't know that what he did or did not do would be grounds for divorce, because I don't know how far it went or anything like that. But obviously, if he's getting too friendly with another woman while he's married, I could see why his wife would be angry. Although it sounds like maybe she was angry before that. I don't know. Anyway,
he owns everything, and he's owned it to her. You know, he wants their marriage to be reconciled.
Yeah.
Whatever the cost. So I'll just.
I'm glad you're there. I'm glad you're there for him. It's going to be hard for you just emotionally to deal with it, but harder for him, I suppose. In any case, yeah, I think your counsel's right at this time.
All right, brother. Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, Jason. Thanks for your call. God bless you. All right. Let's talk to Mark from Seattle, Washington next. Mark, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. My question is Proverbs 31, verses 6 and 7, where it says, "Gives drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more."
Mm-hmm.
How are we to take this in the context of understanding that getting drunk is a sin? And I guess what's your view on alcohol in general? Yeah. And I'll take your answer off the line. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, sure. Thank you for your call. My view about alcohol is that I've never had any use for it, and I don't care for it, but I certainly am not among those who would say that drinking alcohol is a sin. The Bible doesn't say that at all. In fact, Jesus drank alcohol. He obviously took Passover, and they used wine at the Passover, which Jews still do and always did. And, to drink wine was simply what everybody almost had to do, because the water in the ancient world was a little bit like water in the third world today. Not very sanitary, and you could get all kinds of amoebic dysentery and things like that from bad water. So what people in the Latin and the Jewish and the Greek world did in those days, we know this because of the writers of the time, this is documented in their writings, they typically at every table had a pitcher of water and a pitcher of wine, and they would mix it in their glass, usually at least three parts water or more to one part of wine, and that would sanitize the water. And that was how they drank their wine most of the time. Now, if somebody was trying to get drunk, they'd drink the wine straight. But people who didn't want to get drunk or had no interest in getting drunk, they still had the wine there. They had to use the wine to sanitize their water. And that's why Timothy is told by Paul, stop drinking only water, but add a little wine with it for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities. Timothy apparently was trying to be maybe a Nazarite or something and not drink any wine in his water. And Paul said, you're having, stomach problems. You better start putting wine in your water like other people do. And that's just the way it was. So there's nothing in the Bible that says you can't put wine into your mouth or into your body. And in fact, the Bible indicates that there's times when the Bible indicates that God made wine to be a blessing to man, to cheer the heart of man. It says twice in the Bible. But on the other hand, of course, getting drunk is something that is forbidden. Now, when it says give wine to him that is perishing, I think this is more or less not trying to encourage a drunken life, but rather it's similar to giving someone anesthesia. Now, they didn't have anesthesia in those days. And, you've seen probably in the old Westerns where someone had gangrene in their leg and they'd, hold him down on the kitchen table and get the doctor in there with a wood saw and saw his leg off. They'd have to give him a pint of, whiskey or something like that to numb the pain. That's all they could do. In biblical times, they had wine for that kind of thing. Now, would that mean the person would get drunk on that occasion? Well, I guess you could call it that. Or is a person drunk when they're under anesthesia? I mean, what is it? Anesthesia is not a habit. It's not a lifestyle. It's an emergency. It's when you're doing something to be excruciatingly painful without it. And I don't think that God is such a legalist. In fact, it's from Proverbs 30, it doesn't sound like he's a legalist about this. That, if someone can drink enough wine, that it numbs their pain when they're, I assume it's talking about somebody who's dying, someone who's perishing, somebody who's, maybe got stabbed on the battlefield. There's no hope for him. He's just taking a while to die. Give him some wine to ease it. This is what it sounds like it's saying. And to my mind, if it is saying that, that's not in any sense giving permission for people in general to be getting drunk. But it is true that the capacity of fermenting is something that God put into certain sugars and juices and things like that, and yeast, so that things do ferment. And it has a purpose. For one thing, it's a disinfectant. Just using alcohol externally, everyone knows if they've got a medicine cabinet, there's some alcohol in there, and it disinfects. That's a good thing. It's good that God made alcohol. It's also, apparently, it's got a use for anesthesia, but it's not, God didn't make it to be for recreational use. And the Bible would never support that. That is to say drunkenness. I mean, drinking it as a beverage, and when you don't drink enough to get drunk, there's be nothing in the Bible against that. Just like, the people back then would put water in their wine. They obviously didn't drink enough wine that way to get drunk, but they drank wine. People who say you can't put any alcohol in your body because, alcohol is a demon or something, they're going to throw out most of their mouthwashes and their cough syrups and things like that because that's got alcohol in it too. Alcohol has medicinal value in various ways. But frankly, just like marijuana does, obviously a lot of people have made a case for legalizing marijuana because it's got some medicinal value, but it also has a recreational use that isn't consistent with a spiritual life, in my opinion. I think that when you're using a substance to alter your consciousness, you are to that degree losing the control of your mind, maybe in only a small way in some cases, but certainly it's changing it. When you're altering your consciousness with substance, you're not retaining complete control of your state of mind. And when it says here in Proverbs 31 that it's not for kings to drink wine, it says because they might forget justice or they might pervert justice and they might not make good decisions. Obviously, it's saying that if you drink too much wine, it's going to alter your mental state and it'll alter your moral judgment and things like that. And certainly it does. Anyone who's had experience with a drunkard or even with somebody who uses a consciousness-altering drugs knows that it alters their mental state in a way that is, in many cases, detrimental to their own spiritual life. And I've actually been around more people who've altered their mental state with marijuana than with alcohol. I don't really know any real alcoholics, but I've known a lot of people who've abused marijuana, and I can certainly say what's true of alcohol is also true of marijuana in that respect. Let's talk to Janelle from Colorado Springs. Hey, Janelle, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I have a very sad story to tell you, and I desperately need some advice. Mm-hmm. I'm totally blind, and I have a couple of friends that I've had very close since about 1995. It is a woman and her husband. I'm married very happily. But I kind of adopted them as a brother and sister. They took me into their home at one time when I would have been homeless otherwise before my second marriage. And they're just very close to me. Her husband is kind of a joker, you know, and he'll play tricks on me that have to do with my lack of vision or with my hearing. And, you know, we just have a big laugh about it. Well, in the meantime, she and I had developed a very spiritual relationship with one another where we could talk and just share about what was going on in our lives. And I noticed that she hadn't been calling me for weeks and weeks and weeks, so I called her up, and she explained that I had said something very hurtful to her. And the statement that she claimed I made is one that I honestly don't believe in my heart that I mm-hmm. said the words to her that she says I said in the way that I said them. So when she told me that it had really hurt her, I said, well, you know, I kind of just quick prayed in my conscious mind without words to, like, Lord, help me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said to her, I have never known you to lie to me. In all of these 22 years that we've been friends, I've never known you to lie. I've never known you to be deceitful in any way. And I said, if you say that I said it, or since you say that I said it, I will own it because you say I did.
Sure. Sure. So how did things turn out? Did you guys get reconciled?
And I said, I apologize with all my heart. Well, I've tried to talk to her since. I've left messages. She has not returned my calls. And the last message I left her was probably 3 weeks ago or 2.5 weeks ago, something like that. And I just felt in my heart like, A, either I might be driving her away, or B, making her more angry. So I have left it alone. I don't know if she's just hurt or if she's very angry.
So Janelle, what is your question for me today?
My question for you is there anything at all that I can do? I've been praying. Is there anything at all I can do to try to reconcile this relationship, or do I just wait on her and wait on God? What do I do?
Well, that really depends on things in the relationship that I'm not aware of, whether there's things you can do. I'm not sure what you said, why she took offense, you know, what her response was to your apology and things like that. I wasn't there, so there's not a lot that I don't know that I would have to know before I could give you, you know, any kind of a certain answer, even if I could then. But I will say that if you have humbly repented or confessed or apologized, as you say you have, then if she's not forgiven you, she's the one at fault, not you, and there's not something remaining for you to do. Now, sometimes, frankly, I've had people in my life like that, too, that suddenly they cut off contact with me, and when I try to contact them, there's no response, and I think, what? I thought we were, you know, close. And this happened to me, you know, numerous times in life. I'm old, and there's been a lot of cases like that. And it's always disappointing. In many cases, they were good friends, or better than good friends. And I don't know what to say. All I know is that you can't do more than you can do. And the ball is in her court, I would say, unless there's something she's waiting for you to do. Now, if you don't hear anything from her and you're wondering, you know, is there something still that's offending her? There'd be nothing wrong with contacting her and saying, you know, I was wondering if there still remains anything, a problem between us. And if she says yes, well, then deal with that as a separate issue. But if she says no, maybe she's just embarrassed by the whole situation. I don't know. Maybe she's just moved on and doesn't want to be in that relationship anymore. I can think of several cases that I and my wife have had in just in the past several years of people who were close friends, and we don't hear from them anymore, and we don't know why. But that's kind of normal in life. I mean, it shouldn't be normal, but it's common, I should say. And I'm sorry you're going through that, but there's nothing wrong with checking back and saying, is there something else that I'm not thinking of? But if there isn't, you may just have to decide that she's decided to move on and doesn't want to be in your life anymore, which is very sad, as you said, and I'm sorry to hear it. Let's talk to Rich from Briar, Washington. Rich, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I have a question that came up as I was reading Second Chronicles, but as I was reading it, I also noticed that this same thing occurs in other places in the Old Testament. So take, for example, Second Chronicles 29:25, where we have King Hezekiah, I believe it is, and then it's mentioned here, I'm just going to quote a little bit of the passage here. It says, "And he stationed the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, harps, and lyres, according to the commandment of David and of Gad the king's seer and of Nathan the prophet." So my question is, what's the difference between a seer and a prophet?
Actually, they are synonyms, and I'm not sure why sometimes Gad is referred to as a seer and Nathan is referred to as a prophet. But we are told in 1 Samuel that in the days of Saul, at least, now this is a period considerably later you're reading about, but it says in the days of Saul, what we now call a prophet was called a seer, it says. So that a seer and a prophet were basically interchangeable terms. Now, that was in the time of Saul, which was hundreds of years before Hezekiah. But we don't read of there ever being a change in the definitions. Now, it's possible that in those hundreds of years, as languages morph a little bit, that the term seer might have been more restricted to someone who actually saw visions, which prophets in the Old Testament did, and a prophet might be reserved for someone who maybe doesn't see visions but receives oracles. I'm only guessing. I don't know if there is a difference. There's no difference in 1 Samuel. Because that's where we're told that a seer and a prophet are the same thing. But that was a lot earlier in history. And because languages do change and nuances of words morph a little bit, it may be that in the time of Gad and Nathan, that their functions were slightly different in ways that would be described differently. But a seer, by implication, is one who sees visions. And prophets do see visions, at least in the Bible. They do. And a prophet could have been something that began to just refer to someone who gets an oracle from God, a word from the Lord, with or without a vision, maybe without one. But I can't say for sure. All I'm talking about is the meaning of the words, which at one time in history were synonymous.
I'm wondering if another possibility is that a seer came to be an official position to the king. You know, this is the king's, it's not a number of places it says the king's seer.
Yeah.
And might have been a prophet that is specifically has a governmental position bestowed on them. So I don't know.
Well, that's possible because the kings did have prophets attached to their cabinets. However, I know Ahab, for example, in 1 Kings 22, he had prophets attached to him, but they didn't call them seers. They called them prophets there. But, you know, you may be right. It may be in the southern kingdom at that time, you know, a seer was a governmental title for official prophet of the king. But that's only a guess. I mean, it's your guess, and, you know, it might be a good guess or not. We can't really, I don't think we'll have any way of confirming it.
Right. Okay. Okay, thanks. That's all I had. Appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay,
Rich. By the way, I go to your website all the time, and listen to your MP3s. It's very helpful. Very helpful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your call.
Yeah.
God bless you. Bye now. All right. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to Cheryl from Lincoln, California, if she can hold through the break. We have a break that comes up at the bottom of the hour as we dismiss some of the radio stations that carry the program. Our program is an hour long. We've just completed a half hour. A few stations are not going to carry the second half. They cut us off at this point. And so if you're listening to a program, the program on a station that doesn't carry the second half hour, you may feel free to go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and there you will find the program is streamed live. You can hear the whole program. Or if you can't listen live, you can listen later because the archives are there, too, at thenarrowpath.com. There's also a mobile app at thenarrowpath.com at the App Store. So you can get that, and you can listen to the whole program if you wish. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to write to us, the address to write to is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That address, again, is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. It's also possible to donate from the website if you wish, which is, of course, thenarrowpath.com. Please stay tuned if you can, and in about 30 seconds, we'll be coming back to take more calls.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. When today's radio show is over, we invite you to study, learn, and enjoy by visiting thenarrowpath.com, where you'll find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Remember, thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live. We have another half hour together taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, you'd like to call in and talk about those. Or if you have a different viewpoint from that of the host, and that's something you'd like to talk about, you may do so. We have quite a few lines open right now, though they usually fill up pretty quick. So you may want to call this number now rather than later. 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Cheryl calling from Lincoln, California. Cheryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks so much.
Sure.
So I'm doing a study with my women's Bible study on the book of Acts, and I was doing some supplemental reading and so forth, and I came across something yesterday that kind of startled me about what this person was saying. He's a professor at Princeton, or at least was when he wrote this particular lecture, Bible, The Making of the New Testament Canon by Bart D. Ehrman.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, he's an unbeliever. He's an agnostic, but go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Making sense now. Because he was saying that there, in the book of Acts, that there were not in the book of Acts. Excuse me, that the book of Acts and some of the letters of Paul conflicted in fact. He did not give specifics, and he did not give verses to look up. And then he said that at least six of the of Paul's letters are challenged as to whether or not they were written by him or written by followers of him. And I've never heard anything like that about Paul or the book of Acts.
Right. Well, Bart Ehrman is a liberal Bible scholar. Liberal Bible scholars have been around for over a century, and they always say things like that. They always want to challenge whether Moses wrote the Pentateuch, whether Daniel wrote the book of Daniel, whether Isaiah wrote the second part of Daniel. Whether the Gospels were written by the Gospel writers and all of that. And some of them have challenged some of the letters of Paul, too. Suffice it to say, there is nothing that would compel an objective reader to question whether Paul wrote all the 12 or 13 apostles, depending on Hebrews, attributed to him. And you know, I mean, people can be as skeptical as they want to be, and it's in the nature of liberal scholarship to be skeptical of anything traditional or anything that has been believed in religion for a long time. But the truth is, while it is a good idea to challenge traditions from time to time, make sure that they're not just continuing without any validity, to overthrow traditions without good reason is not a very a good policy, in my opinion. I believe that the reason for accepting Paul's letters as from Paul, among other things, is because they say they are, and that the early church believed they were. And the early church knew Paul. In fact, the early church received those letters sent to them by Paul. So, I mean, somebody living 20 centuries later saying, well, you know, I don't think Paul wrote that. Well, who cares what you think, you know?
Right.
There's as many people who are scholarly who think he did. So you can think whatever you want to, but to say he didn't write them is simply a statement of one's own prejudice and one's own conjecture. Now, that's what liberal scholars do all the time. You may have heard of the Jesus Seminar. It's a compendium of liberal scholars who got together to decide whether anything in the books of the Gospels were true or not. And they decided that Jesus only said about 20% of the things the Gospels say. But how did they decide it? They just took a vote. They just thought, well, do you think Jesus would say something like that? No, I don't. Do you? No, I'm voting against it, you know. And they had, you know, they're just totally arbitrary. They're totally subjective. And whereas to believe...
Well, it will do me good to finish listening to this, I guess, with that knowledge so that I'll know how the other side is portraying the Gospels. But when I need truth and commentary that's based on truth, I will rely on yours. And I did read also Bonhoeffer's The Cost of Discipleship.
Uh-huh.
And I felt that was also very worthy.
Well, you don't have to... Yeah, it's a good book, a very good book. You don't have to rely on my commentaries alone. You know, the things I say about the Bible and the canon stuff are pretty much what scholarly Christians have said for 20 centuries, except for the liberals who have decided to challenge it. But they don't challenge it on the basis of anything compelling, just on the basis of their tendency to be skeptical. And in many cases, I think their desire not to believe. But... you know, when he said that some of the things Paul wrote don't agree with what's in the epistle or in Acts, this is not true. It is true that the things in 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, Paul mentions some travels in those epistles that are not mentioned in the book of Acts, but that's because the book of Acts only tells the story up through Paul's first imprisonment. And 2nd Timothy, for example, was written during Paul's second imprisonment. There was some time in between where he traveled. So in 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, we have him making reference to travels that he made after his first imprisonment. And the book of Acts was written before that. Those travels are not mentioned in the book of Acts because it was written too early to include them. Now, as far as Paul's own testimony of his conversion, sometimes people feel they have a serious conflict between Acts 9, where Paul's conversion is told, and Galatians 1, where Paul tells his conversion too. In fact, I've had people tell me those two cannot be harmonized at all. However, once you've decided they can't be harmonized, that means you're not going to accept any harmonization that someone suggests. I have no trouble harmonizing them at all. To me, it's very a relatively simple thing to harmonize what Paul says in Acts 9 and what Luke says in Acts 9 and what Paul says in Galatians 1. They do give different details, but it'd be crazy to assume that Luke was making stuff up and that he was changing the story. There's nothing about the way it's told in Acts that would be, you know, beneficial to Luke to put that way if it wasn't true. And Luke traveled with Paul for years. He knew the story inside and out. So to say that Luke writing the book of Acts conflicted with what Paul said about his own conversion is simply to be negative beyond what it's called for. It's very easy to harmonize those passages, but those who don't want to think it's easy to harmonize them, those who don't want to believe them, they'll just say, oh, they can't be harmonized. They're in conflict with each other.
Well, I think something else that I'm learning in all of this, too, because I also read some Lee Strobel's, and these are not to be verse-by-verse repeats of each other. There are actual events that happen that people are giving testimony to, and if it was verbatim the same, then you would be suspect of it being coerced.
Well, you're quite right.
Yeah,
exactly. If Luke wrote Paul's conversion in exactly the same words Paul wrote it, giving only the same details and omitting all the same details that Paul omitted, you just figure, well, you know, he's just copying it out of Galatians or something. But the fact that it is different, although he traveled with Paul, knew Paul, and knew the story well, we'd have to just say that what Luke tells us that Paul doesn't is supplementing what Paul tells us. Luke certainly had more information about it than we have written by Paul, because Paul didn't write that much about it, and Luke traveled with him for years, so he'd know a lot more details and recorded some of them. Hey, Cheryl, my lines are full. I need to talk to some other people here. But thank you for calling today. We're going to talk next to Rebecca from Boise, Idaho. Rebecca, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have just a quick question about Gospels in the Bible. My daughter's been asking me about extra Gospels that weren't put into the Bible, like you said, the book of Jasher and the book of Thomas, and I've never really researched that, so I was curious.
Well, the book of Jasher is not a gospel. The book of Jasher, the real book of Jasher, is a very old book dating from the time of Joshua or so. The book of Joshua actually makes reference to the book of Jasher. Now, you can go to a store and buy a book of Jasher, but the idea that that's the same book of Jasher that existed in the days of Joshua is a little naive, I think. It represents itself as such, but hey, I could do that too. I mean, Paul mentioned in 5:9, that he had written a previous letter to the Corinthians about avoiding immorality. I could write a book against immorality and say, hey, this is Paul's first letter to the Corinthians that he mentions there. Just because a book is mentioned in the Bible and then one turns up and claims to be that book doesn't give any real reason to believe it is that book. I don't believe that the book of Jasher, which I think the book of Jasher appeared in print like in the 1900s, which is a long time after Joshua's day. I don't think there's any reason to believe it's the same book of Jasher the Bible mentions. Now, as far as the Gospel of Thomas, the best reason not to accept the Gospel of Thomas, well, there's two good reasons. One is that Thomas didn't write it, and therefore it's written by a forger. And the second is that it's a Gnostic gospel. It teaches a Gnostic heresy that was very popular in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, which is when the Gospel of Thomas was written, long after Thomas was dead. Now, the reason that the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are in the Bible is because the 1st century church, who knew those men, received those books from them and remembered that they wrote them. It's interesting. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't even put their own names in the books. We know their names because the church remembered who wrote them. And therefore, and we can be quite sure the church didn't make up those names. Because if they had an anonymous book and they weren't sure who wrote it and they wanted to add a prestigious author to it, they wouldn't pick Mark or Luke, who are essentially unknown guys. Luke is not even mentioned in the book of Acts, though he wrote it, and not by name. And, in fact, he's not mentioned in the Bible at all, except in a couple places where Paul's listing people with him. In Colossians and Philemon, he mentions Luke is with him. But there's hardly a person more obscure in the Bible than Luke. And so why would anyone put his name on it if he wasn't really the author? The church had a vested interest in knowing who wrote their historical works because they were basing their faith and their lives on them. They were willing to die. And they were. They burned at the stake. They were fed to the lions. You're not going to do that while you're trying to fool people about, you know, you're going to only die for what you really believe. And they really did believe. And they had reason to know who wrote those books. Irenaeus wrote about 170 A.D., and he said that the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the only four Gospels which are accepted, and they are universally accepted in all the churches throughout the world. Now, this is like 150 years before Constantine. People who've read Dan Brown's books, you know, the Da Vinci Code and other nonsense, sometimes say, well, Constantine, you know, he banished all the other Gospels because he didn't like them, and he only chose Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to be in our Bible. That's such nonsense. He wasn't converted till like 312 or 313 A.D., and it was almost 150 years before that Irenaeus and another writer at the time both identified Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as the only accepted gospels throughout the whole church. So you've got, you know, you've got reasons to accept the four gospels. The other gospels, the gospel of Peter, the gospel of Thomas, the gospel of Judas, the gospel of Philip, the gospel of Mary, and so forth, they were all written in the second and third centuries by people who were forging their names in order to try to give them credibility. The church fathers who were contemporary with those books knew those books, and they identified them as false gospels. But the church knew which ones were real, and the ones that are in the Bible are the ones that are real.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. She's been kind of questioning the validity of the Bible. I'm not sure exactly why. It's not how she was raised, but...
How old is she?
She will be 25 here in a couple months.
And she's trying to
go her own way, do her own thing, and she's wondering...
Did she go to college?
She is not in college right now. She has had some college.
Yeah. See, that's what does it to a lot of kids. A lot of kids go to college, and the professors don't know one thing about the facts. All they know is they don't like Christianity, so they glom onto any ridiculous rumor that is passing through the fictional world, and they teach it as if it's true so that their students begin to say, wow, maybe my parents were wrong. No, they weren't. It's the professors that are wrong. Professors don't understand what they're talking about most of the time.
She did go to a Bible college.
Then she maybe didn't get it at college, but she got it from somewhere after that then, or before that. But the thing is that college campuses are in many cases set up to destroy Christian faith. Not Christian college campuses, certainly. But sometimes Christian college campuses sometimes have that effect too, because sometimes the legalism or something at a certain college campus, Christian one, can drive people away. There's different kinds. And in any case, a girl raised in a Christian home and 25 years old is very susceptible to a lot of the lies that are out there, because there's a huge amount of YouTube videos and books written and magazine articles and academic professors who are all saying all the same stupid things that aren't true. But the real scholars know. But the ones who are unbiased. But we're not talking about unbiased. She's hearing from people who are not unbiased, and that's the problem, unfortunately. But the Gospels in the Bible are not like the Gospels, the so-called Gnostic Gospels. The Gospels in the Bible were written by people in the first century who knew Jesus or knew the disciples of Jesus. The Gnostic Gospels were written by people who were several generations removed and never saw Jesus or an apostle. All right, let's talk to Stephanie from Cool, California. Hi, Stephanie.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
I didn't know there was a place called Cool, California. Is that correct? Cool?
It is, yes. It's a small gold rush town near Sacramento.
Oh, that's interesting.
My question for you is that I've talked many times to my son who's 25, and he struggles with a lot of what's in the Bible. And I think my first question is, I would like to know how you would explain to him the reason that God created people, and if he knows all and knows the future, why he would create those people that he knew were going to go to heaven.
You mean weren't going to heaven?
I mean that he knew were going to go to hell, excuse me.
Well, to me, it's obvious that some of the people who are going to heaven are descended from some people who went to hell, right?
Okay, yeah.
So why should God deprive himself of his faithful people just because some of their ancestors want to be stubborn and not be saved? Why should God be required when he gives everyone free will? Anyone's going to choose to go where they go. If these people who went to hell could stand before God and say, it's no fair that you created me knowing I was going to go to hell, I think God's answer would rightly be, well, I created you and gave you the opportunity not to go to hell. I gave you the opportunity to become a believer. You chose not to. That's your choice. I didn't make you do that. And the fact that you're doing it doesn't entitle you to deprive me of your grandchildren who are going to serve me. I mean, that'd be an obvious answer to me.
Yeah, and that's something that I didn't think of talking to him about. So that's a very good way to look at it. and I guess his next question might be, well, why would God create that person, even though why wouldn't he just create people that he knew would go to heaven? But then that takes away from the free will.
Well, sure. And also, like I said, not everyone who's going to heaven is descended from only people who went to heaven. There are certain unbelievers. I don't know who they are because my parents and grandparents are all Christians, but there are some unbelievers in my lineage. If you go back far enough, there's got to be someone out there who's an unbeliever. And if that person wasn't born, then I wouldn't be born.
Right.
I'm glad that God made me because he gave me an opportunity to know him and to serve him.
Right. And that's got to be wrapped up in the free will.
Well, it is. I mean, no one can claim that they were, well, Calvinists claim, but they're not speaking according to Scripture, in my opinion. But no one can rightfully claim on God's behalf that God hasn't given anyone a choice about the matter. Everyone has a choice, and the choice you make is going to be, you'll be judged for that. And the result of that judgment is some people are going to be condemned because they made choices purposely that were the wrong choices. But they're all part of the history of the world where, you know, they're links in a chain of generations where God has some plans for some of these people. And he would have a plan for them, too, if they accepted his terms and followed him. But the fact that they don't doesn't throw God into a tizzy where he can't function. You know, oh, no, that person's not going to accept me. So it's going to thwart my whole purposes for history. No, he's going to let them make their choice. Let them make their choice and take the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that helps me understand how he knows everything and all things and all the future. And if you look at it that way, it's a little easier to understand. That's great. And then, ironically, I was just talking to my 21-year-old son today, and a lot of what you just said to the previous caller is very helpful for me. And that's his concern right now, and he's been my closest one to God. And, again, he is in college, but he is very conservative, but I'm not sure where he's questioning now the validity of the Bible. And he's very concerned and thinks that how could it all be directly from God, because over so many years, wouldn't it have been rewritten? These people who write it were not God.
Well, that's a question that he can actually look into the answer. Fortunately, that question can be explored and answered. There are questions we have that we can't explore because we don't have enough information, but this is certainly one we have, because ever since the time of the New Testament, not the exact time, but within a few couple centuries of the New Testament, we have documents, manuscripts of the New Testament, and we can compare those ancient documents, the manuscripts from those periods, with those of later periods, and we can just see how much has it changed. And there are scholars who spend their whole lives doing that. They're called textual critics. Textual criticism is the science of comparing ancient manuscripts to see how much they have changed over the years. And there's some of the best minds in science working on this. And basically what they say is you see a few little changes here and there, to be sure, because when people make a copy, they sometimes make a mistake. But the astonishing thing is there aren't any major mistakes that would change the meaning of the story or the meaning of the message. So even if we say, well, maybe this word or that word, might not have been in the original, maybe a copyist put that in there, still, the story is clear. I mean, a person has no excuse for rejecting the Bible based on any assumptions that it's changed through copying. That can be actually quantified by scholars who have looked into that. In fact, the Old Testament, until the 1940s, when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, which contained Hebrew manuscripts of the Old Testament, the Old Testament manuscripts we had until 1948 or so, the manuscripts we had dated from about 1008 A.D. In other words, the manuscripts we had were about 1,000 years old But they were manuscripts of the Old Testament, so they were really not very, they weren't very close to the Old Testament. They were at least 1,500 years after the Old Testament was written, these manuscripts came into being. But when we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, they date back 1,000 years further back, and there were copies of the Hebrew Scriptures in there. And so they were able to compare the Dead Sea Scrolls with the Hebrew Scriptures we already had and found out exactly, and they can quantify exactly how much it's changed in 1,000 years of copying. Because right. the gap between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text they were using before is 1,000 years. So there was copying going on for that 1,000 years. And they said, it's 95% verbatim. And the 5% that is not verbatim is made up of misspelled words, or the word order is changed in a sentence, but it doesn't change the meaning, or other kinds of grammatical slips of the pen. There are a few little changes that aren't significant. They say no major doctrine or story is altered or impaired by whatever kind of changes have taken place. And all the changes together are no more than 5%. So if I could have 95% certainty that what I'm reading is the Word of God, mm-hmm. I guess I value God enough to say, that's pretty good. I want to read that. And if there's 5% that I'm not so sure about, well, I'd want to find out what 5% that is and why. It's not just that you can pick out the 5% you don't like and say, I don't like that. But actually, there are some words in some passages that read a little differently in different passages, but they're not going to change anything of significance. You know, I have a series that your sons might benefit from at my mm-hmm. website. You can listen to. They're MP3 files, and it's free. Everything at the website is free. I've got hundreds of lectures there, but there's a set of 14 lectures called The Authority of Scripture. And the opening lectures in that series talk about these very things in detail. The very skeptical questions that people have about the Bible are anticipated and addressed in those lectures at the very beginning. So it's called The Authority of Scripture. And if you want to find those for your sons, if they're interested in listening, the website is thenarrowpath.com. And that's thenarrowpath.com. And you go to the tab that says topical lectures, and you'll find the series called The Authority of Scripture. And if they listen to that, it'll answer most of those questions.
Yeah.
And it's not just me. It's not just me. I'm quoting what the actual textual critics say and what the authorities say. It's mainly made up of their quotations.
And his last comment to me was that he doesn't understand why we can't see the old sea scrolls. That they haven't been released for 70 years, and he thinks that
they've been on display.
I don't know
where
he heard that from.
They've traveled around the country. I think if I'm not mistaken, not long ago they were on display in Seattle. You can't handle them; they're too brittle,
right.
You know. But they're under glass. Yeah, they've any scholar who's ever wanted to has had access to look at them, and anyone who's not a scholar probably can't make any sense of them anyway because they're in ancient Hebrew. But nonetheless, they have been on display, and I think they made a world tour or a United States tour.
I thought that was the case. But okay, well, thank you very much. That's very good information, and I appreciate all you do. And I just kind of found your program, and I'm really enjoying it.
Well, I'm glad you found it. God bless you, Stephanie.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye now. All right, we don't have very much time left, and in fact, the music just played, which means we only have about a minute left. So my apologies to those of you that didn't get on, but hopefully you can call tomorrow, and we can talk to you then. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday. We do buy the time on radio stations so that you can hear us, and that money doesn't come from sponsors. We don't sell anything on the program or at the website. We don't have commercial breaks. We got no sponsors, no underwriters, no church underwriting it. We just have this announcement at the end of the program that we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. And the website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.